Hello and welcome to my latest podcast episode, which is Janine Green ASB Chats Partnership Working. Now, before we start going into the content and I welcome my guests, it's just a little bit of a disclaimer from me to say that I am currently recording podcast episodes in the middle of lockdown. And I say that just to so people are clear that I'm not in the same room as my guest. So if there's any kind of speaking over each other, then just please forgive us. And also if you hear any children or dogs in the background or doors knocking, then again, please forgive us because we are all stuck at home like everybody else at the moment. Now, for any of you that's listened to my podcast recordings before, you'll know that they all follow the same kind of format, which is me inviting an expert guest to have a discussion about an area of particular relevance in relation to antisocial behaviour. And I think today's topic of discussion is particularly relevant. So today we're going to be talking about partnership working. And certainly for anybody that works in antisocial behaviour, when I talk to people about what obstacles and what challenges case managers face, very often partnership working and problem solving comes up quite high when we discuss those challenges. So I'm hoping today that we're going to have a really good conversation about what makes for effective partnership working and also explore some of the things that are working well and some good practice that perhaps your listeners can kind of take away and put into practice yourself. So that leaves me to introduce my guest for this session. I'm really delighted to introduce Darren Burton, who is head of housing consultancy at Forbes Solicitors. So I'm sure many of you will know Darren. Darren's worked in housing for a number of years, but without kind of stealing his thunder. Firstly, Darren, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really grateful for you to give up your time to have this chat with me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
No problem. And I just wondered really if we could start nice and gently and whether you could introduce yourself to the listeners and just tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
Okay then. My name's Darren Burton, head of housing consultancy at Forbes. It's a fairly new role, been in operation for about 2 years now. Basically putting a housing management ASB service within a legal firm, focusing on the things that I've done throughout my housing career, basically, such as supporting housing providers to establish and strengthen effective partnership links, looking at early intervention and frontline service delivery, helping along with case building. And that might just be something that you're supporting a frontline housing officer or an ASB officer with a tiny piece of the case, going away, sorting that problem and coming back whilst they keep ownership of the case. So anything that's not legal, really, not pretending to be a solicitor or getting involved in those areas. And I think having the full length of the case to work on with my colleagues, and again, there is obviously a handover point with the solicitors, then we can have that consistency and hopefully work as best as we can with our housing colleagues based on the work that I've done over the past 25 years now.
Lovely. And it's really neatly kind of led me into the next question. You talk about kind of 25 years of experience. And I know we've worked together for a number of years now as well. And I know certainly, you know, several years ago, problem solving was a big thing in terms of the work that you were doing. And I remember the stuff that you were doing around hoarding particularly and building partnership models and really tackling some of those difficult issues. I know that one of the things that you're doing at the moment with Forbes is looking at a kind of problem solving model that really kind of focuses on partnership working and creative practices. Can you tell me a little bit more about that model and perhaps how it's come about to be and why you're focusing such efforts on that kind of area?
Yeah, sure. When we first started with the role, I had a bit of an open brief, really. So it was a good opportunity for a good 10 or 12 months to go out and fact find, to meet with housing providers, to meet with local authorities, police, the voluntary sector, all different agencies, and find out what those barriers are. And a lot of this was done in conjunction with the research team at the Office of the Police and Crime Commission at West Yorkshire. My colleague Wendy Stevens has been fantastic help, to be honest, and we worked together in some other areas as well. Needless to say, you'll be no surprised. The issues were, and again, your listeners will be only too familiar with these as well, information sharing, responses to breaches of injunctions with power of arrest, escalating safeguarding thresholds, facilitating greater collaboration with mental health teams, trying to find some consistency in how to approach, you know, long-standing hoarding cases. And I suppose most importantly, really focusing on the importance of housing within the ASB and community safety sector, and making sure that, you know, there's an active role and all that knowledge and experience that so many practitioners have can be fed into the mix and get the best possible results and outcomes for vulnerable victims, members of the community, and everyone concerned, really. So that's basically led us on to looking at a type of model, where to start, which areas. And having worked in West Yorkshire for a number of years, as have my colleagues, and again, following on from, I suppose, some of the barriers that I'd experienced as a practitioner, as someone who'd headed an ASB service as well, looking at how we can address those in a simple, uncomplicated way without duplicating any of the existing partnerships and strategic forums and the various meetings. Because, as you know, you could make an industry out of going to meetings as well, and often you'd find that there'd be a subgroup, a task and finish group, and the same people often sat around the tables, but not always decision makers as well, which was frustrating. So what we were looking at doing was having something that almost sort of sits next to, not necessarily above, the existing community safety partnerships, that if an issue hits an ASB or a safeguarding threshold, that practitioners know that it reached that threshold, obviously based on their experience, and it's very clear. Then how do they go about dealing with things? Don't want to encounter delays, being passed from pill to post, having protracted email conversations about, you know, whose responsibility and whose role it is, and also identifying so many differences, even local offices from different organisations who might just be a mile or two away dealing with things completely different, and making sure that there's an opportunity to get involved. Community safety partnerships, in my experience, often housing can be restricted to just the main stock transfer landlord, or maybe the ALMO, and the larger national housing associations who maybe just have dispersed stock, maybe, you know, a handful of properties or a couple of hundred in a particular area, are almost not invited to the party at times. And we thought this was like the missed opportunity for all concerned, as I'm sure, you know, you'd be familiar with some of the clients you work with. But little things, you know, someone who couldn't commit to attending a MARAC on a daily basis or a weekly basis was kind of saying, well, how do we get involved in the project? And it was becoming a barrier, you know, even though there was knowledge there and key information to be supplied into that partnership. Others waiting up to 18 months to get signed up to an information sharing protocol, where maybe in the next local authority or another region, they had really strong links and they already had, which was pretty much the same document. So it's overcoming those barriers and just getting everyone who can make a difference, decision makers. If it hits that threshold, then it's basically a case of what can we do about it? Share our knowledge, share our resources, our ideas, our innovation, and come up with a model. And for that particular case, a strategy, and get it done, really. A lot can be done in real time over the phone, providing that's backed up with appropriate information sharing and obviously all the GDPR compliance, which is massive and rightly so. But just kind of thinking a bit differently and not being held up by the red tape that often exists. And again, it's frustrating for everyone, even those who are bound by it. But just looking how we can overcome that to offer a better service to vulnerable victims in the community, to improve customer satisfaction for housing providers, and just see that things are getting done and making a difference. And again, that enthusiasm and everything that goes with that to improve the areas we live in.
So just so I'm clear in my mind, are the meetings actually looking at particular cases, or are they looking at principles? So are they looking at partnership challenges, or if that makes sense, or are they actually looking at individual cases of ASB?
Both, really, but anything that's a barrier, anything that's an issue that they could contribute to. And I think what's been useful as well, in the West Yorkshire situation, with Forbes working with the majority of housing providers in that area, but also having good relations with the ones that we don't currently work with, who, you know, use other legal firms, it's just an opportunity for everyone to work collaboratively and to share information. So in a number of examples where different housing providers who we don't actually work with, but we have that relationship with, will provide us with stats, say, if there's been a spike in domestic abuse in their particular areas for whatever, and then we can link that back in with the police as well to get a really accurate picture about what's happening in the communities. So anything that's a barrier, and having myself obviously acting as a point of contact for the housing providers, and Wendy and her colleagues in the Police and Crime Commissioner feeding in with those agencies. So you've got two key points of contact that everything goes in. And what we've asked for as well, and again, it's still very much an evolving process, but depending on the size of the organisation, we ask for either one or two strategic contacts and two operational, so that anyone who needs to get to the people with the answers can do, and are not sort of held up with contact centres or often going onto an internet site to look for a particular person and can't find them. And mm-hmm. so you're getting that direct response, which is speeding things along, which is improving case length. And again, that satisfaction. And again, look, if something worked in a particular area, then the idea is we can, you know, transfer that and replicate that with a bit of a local variation somewhere else. And also working with providers nationally as well. Say if something was working successfully in Bristol, then why can't that be replicated in Gateshead and vice versa, for argument's sake? And just kind of not reinventing the wheel and looking at, you know, the best ideas, all the knowledge and you know, the really proactive approach from housing associations, putting that to best possible use and getting things done. So it really is a very simplistic model. But the fact that it's endorsed by the Police and Crime Commissioner has been a massive help. And we're also in very initial discussions with other areas to work with PCCs elsewhere and to share that knowledge, almost as testimony from this pilot that it actually works. So some examples, dealing with issues of drug dealing in areas, having direct lines to people in the police, the drug squads, who will come and meet with key practitioners in housing associations. To have that face-to-face, obviously, I know it's a bit different now with the coronavirus pandemic and a lot will be done virtually, but, you know, just seeing people and building trust and having that rapport and seeing what that service can offer and, you know, getting that confidence to work with someone, really. So therefore, you know, rather than traditionally housing having to go to neighbourhood policing teams and then not necessarily being able to escalate it in some situations, you've got the key people from those designated departments, whether it be someone who's dealing with serious organised crime, domestic abuse, drugs. You've got the people who can deliver. And I think that sends out a really good strong message to housing associations and their tenants that you've got people who can deliver on that. And also it gives a greater insight to police, local authorities and other agencies of what housing can actually offer. And then once you've got that rapport and that structure and that process in place, then future cases and issues are dealt with a lot slicker. That's certainly the template.
Absolutely. And I think you've mentioned a couple of times already about, you know, the important role that housing do play, but actually often that can be undervalued and not recognised. So, yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. I guess my kind of role in this episode is to kind of ask questions that the listeners might be thinking in their mind. And I suppose one of the questions that's leaked into my head, and I think you answered this a little bit as we've gone through, but perhaps I could ask you just to summarise, is we have lots of kind of partnership meetings that look at ASB. So I suppose I'm thinking of whatever areas call them, like tasking meetings or JPAGs, yep. Community MARICs. What's the difference then with this kind of model that you've taken? What's the kind of, if you were to summarise the key differences, what would you put them as?
For this model, I think it's almost like reinforcing the issues and having that endorsement and that support. That you've got your community MARACs, your ASB panels and whatever they're called in the different areas. So that case knowledge is always there. But I think this is almost like giving a bit of a push to get the right people around the table to make sure that agencies commit, because they're part of this network, again, endorsed by the PCC and supported by senior management within the constabulary as well, that, you know, you'll have those answers if people can't attend. I know in the past we've all been to meetings where a certain agency hasn't turned up for whatever reason, obviously, you know, with capacity or it could be anything. But making sure that you're not going to those meetings and saying, oh, we'll defer that case till the next one, or we can't really do anything. It's very much keeping the ball moving and getting things done and having those answers and people who can deliver. Even if it's a no, it's better to have a no then. And then we can look at other avenues and put measures in place. But rather than kind of, you know, having drawn out meetings with people who'll have to say, you know, I'll have to take it back to my line manager, for example, or, you know, I can't give you an answer on this. It's very much, this is what we need to do. Can we do it? Yes, no, go down that path. And I think having that endorsement of the best practice partnership that kind of sits and doesn't duplicate what's happening on the ground. And again, there's some fantastic work happening in all areas that we hear about on a regular basis. But it's just just giving that extra push where it's needed as well to get things done, really, particularly around information sharing, because people could be going around in circles and still not getting a response, or, you know, particularly if you're having to go through a governance team, or you don't have the contacts there, or, you know, you may be dealing with people you've never dealt with before. But again, it's putting, as those representatives from those respective organisations at both a strategic and an operational level, then those links are there and it can only be built on to the betterment of the whole process.
Absolutely. I know from the times that we've spoken before that as part of this problem solving model, you do have buy-in from kind of public health and social care, mental health teams. And yeah. I think there'll be people listening that would be like, how on earth have you managed to achieve that? And particularly in such a short space of time, because I think I'd take, for example, if I'm ever delivering ASB training to people and talking about partnership working and information sharing, inevitably the organisations that always are kind of frowned upon as maybe not coming to the table are social services and mental health teams, rightly or wrongly. And I suppose the question really is, how have you managed to engage them? How have you managed to draw them into the process and get them around the table?
Right. I mean, it's still not a panacea, but I think for getting social care teams involved, a lot of that has been done around with working closely with elected members as well. And sometimes we've had to say, you know, there's a real potential for a serious case review or a fatality in this area. Then can you link in with a respective lead for adult social care, for example, for health scrutiny or something like that, and getting those around the table and getting those responses. And I think sometimes it's often the only way that, you know, you need pressure to get people around the table. I know resources are very stretched. I know we often are critical of social care in terms of, you know, the responses and thresholds, which is a major issue. But when housing is in, based on the increased knowledge of housing in the last, 10 or 15 years, I suppose, even more around safeguarding, being the eyes and ears on the estate, seeing things that are, you know, that stand out, that have alarm bells ringing, and almost saying, you know, particularly working for a legal firm now, you can say, you know, we really do need you to act. We're recommending strongly, based on this evidence, based on, you know, the victims, the witness statements, everything we've dealt with, the feedback from the other agencies, that something needs to be done. You know, and that's often around if someone needs to be, if as well as a victim needs to be rehoused or something like that, you know. So it's really, really forcing that message home to get them on board. You know, we're not just picking up on minor cases which don't even meet their thresholds. When we're contacting them, it's for a very specific reason that we need their help and their expertise and their support. And
I suppose that's the other value of what you're saying about having strategic level people involved in the process, you know, is you've got that opportunity to put that pressure on from senior people, which sadly, unfortunately, is sometimes the only way that we get the outcome that we need.
And even if they can't attend, they will delegate someone who can give those answers and work collaboratively. And I think also there's, and we're looking at doing some training on this as well, the whole clarity of roles between housing and social care. And I think sometimes at meetings, social care have been a bit cautious as to think, oh, we're going to be there to be shot at because we're the ones saying no when everyone wants this person moved, or they want to proceed with an injunction, or they want to look at possession. And social care are perhaps, you know, appearing to rub against that when it's not necessarily the case. So it's looking at the best possible approaches, hearing what they have to say. And I think what's been useful as well is just, you know, having that knowledge and hearing from them themselves, because sometimes if you're going through a triage system, it's a bit like doctor's receptionist where you can't get past that first level. So even if you need to speak to a senior manager or a director, it's kind of blocked. So we're saying, let's have that dialogue. And again, with other agencies supporting what we're doing. So if you're working with senior managers at the police or directors of community safety with the local authority, then, you know, they're part of that mix and they need that response as well. So it's got to be fully coordinated. So social care needs to be part of that. And we don't want a situation where we're having to progress legal action and it could be unavoided. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword with that.
And I think some of this is around... We've spoken about this before, haven't we, I think? But, you know, some of this is about understanding language and finding joint objectives, because you know, very often it might be that housing could be talking about certain things that perhaps social care or mental health teams don't understand, and vice versa. And so there's this initial perception of what the intention is, and actually that intention might be inaccurate, and it's about finding joint outcomes. And I think sometimes what we also do is we kind of allow a case that we dealt with maybe 15 years ago, where we struggled to engage with these teams, to kind of cloud our judgment still. And we almost don't try to have the conversations with those teams because we automatically feel like it's going to be a waste of our time. And so I think sometimes it's about going back and refreshing those relationships and educating each other on what's trying to be achieved.
And just, again, going back to promoting the value of housing as well, in some areas, coming at it from a different angle, working with clinical commissioning groups. So you're looking at how housing can provide data on, say, issues with, I don't know, smoking in the community, social prescribing, how housing can help with that. So, again, you're contributing to the CCGs and a health model. So in return, we'll say, you know, how about helping us out with this mental health query? You know, so you're getting the buy-in because you're given something the other way, and it's a two-way process. So they're seeing the value of what housing can do.
And that's the core of partnership working, isn't it? That you give something back in return for what you get. And that's, I think that's the I always say to people, that's the key of getting people to help, is what can you offer in return? The other thing that was really interesting to me there, what you talked about, was getting those parties engaged by highlighting the risk involved in cases. And I suppose what it just brought up in my mind is, again, reiterating the reason why we really need to take a kind of harm-centred approach to the work that we do, that we need to make sure we're doing our risk assessments, that we need to make sure that we're making a proper assessment of risk or harm, because not only is it to best support the people that we work with, but it's only then that we've got the evidence to try and get the other teams to engage with us.
I think what's been useful there as well is, as part of our team, we've got a former superintendent, detective superintendent, who was heading up the safeguarding unit as well. So on behalf of housing providers, he's been able to go in and ask the right questions. You know, he's led on serious case reviews numerous occasions. So having those conversations with social care that perhaps we weren't able to do as housing practitioners, you know, and again, having that buy-in, which we can feed back to strengthen our cases and get those outcomes that we need. So I think it's looking at how we can approach things, and again, who's best placed to go into that particular agency, put the case forward, get the answers, and also find out from other agencies what the barriers are to working with housing. And again, we still come across those examples where, you know, as soon as housing get involved with a vulnerable person, does that, or an ESB case with a perpetrator, are they looking at, you know, rehousing? Are they looking at eviction? Are they looking at, you know, the legal enforcement? And it's reiterating that that is an absolute last resort, only when it's justified. So it's very much the supportive role, the early role of housing, to get in there as soon as possible, to work with other agencies from a health perspective, to get things right, to help people move forward with their lives, and for us to be there when tenants need us, to provide that support, that signposting, and that level of care, but not just coming in and saying, right, you know, let's crack on with some enforcement because it's in no one's interest.
And I think you've perfectly given an example there of what I mean in terms of making sure that all agencies are educated on what the other is trying to achieve, because you're absolutely right. You might have some support services that mistakenly believe that housing are all about evicting. So I think it is important that we refresh those relationships from time to time. You mentioned...
I think what's useful there, regarding the model as well, because we represent a number of housing providers, we can. It's not a barrier if people are working at further away at a wider geographic area. We can say, you know, these are the issues of, you know, 7 or 8 different providers. So we're putting that to the partnership, to other agencies, and there's those common themes, so we can get things done, and we're showing a more united approach, really, just by working together in those numbers.
Kind of people power approach, I guess.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
So I suppose you mentioned information sharing. And don't worry, I'm not going to kind of put you on the spot and get you to tell me all the kind of rules around information sharing, you'll be pleased to hear. But I just wondered whether you've come across any initial resistance when you were setting the model up in terms of getting people to the meeting and sharing information, was there any concerns from the agencies that you wanted around the table about sharing information?
I think a lot of the time, frontline police officers want to share information with the best will in the world. They're committed to doing that. But maybe if an organisation's had the fingers burnt in the past where information's been shared with the right intentions, but they've come unstuck through through regulations and disclosure, then they're less likely to. And I think, as you said earlier, if it's that one initial situation, then sometimes a drawbridge can go down. So it's overcoming that. Obviously, I think the benefit of having, like many legal firms do as well, having a specialist GDPR and compliance team can give that extra reassurance behind the work that we do as housing practitioners as well, to be clear on that. But really focusing that if there's a safeguarding risk, then it's better to share. And that mantra that's, you know, that we all stand by, and really being clear on why we need it, who it's going to, and what the purpose of it is for. But if there's alarm bells ringing and it could result in, you know, something serious, then it's better to share that. And I think, again, it goes back to the trust element as well. If you're working with a full department, you're working with decision makers, you're having access to senior managers as well, then they know you as a firm, you as a housing provider, and you've got that trust to share and to work on that report, and they know why you need it. And again, particularly where there's safeguarding issues and vulnerabilities, the Police and Crime Commissioners are very much behind that. So again, you're sharing it to solve an issue, to keep people safe, and that's fundamental. So I think there is still some resistance, and it differs greatly from area to area. What we have done, as again, keeping the simplicity of it all, has gone down to a particular area with an organisation. We've had, say, an ASB manager or a housing manager, the partnerships inspector or a chief inspector, and the relevant contacts and personnel from the police, just to say, look, been going around in circles with this information sharing agreement. What's the delay? This particular organisation have got, you know, 40 different information sharing agreements across the country. Why is it taking so long in this particular area? And they can't always answer it, because it's kind of gone into a black hole somewhere within the constabulary or within the local authority. And, you know, through no one's fault, I guess, it's just nothing's happened. So basically, right, let's kind of put something together now, because they're all much of a much, aren't they? So, yeah, you know, making sure that let's go away and get it signed off, and it's there and it's active. So when a housing officer or an ASB officer has to ring up to request information, have you got an agreement? Yes, we have. But also we were finding that some housing providers were still using information sharing agreements that were significantly out of date, but no one had told them to refresh them, or, you know, there'd been no consensus around that. So they were perhaps saying, oh, we've got an agreement in place, and maybe someone new might answer the phone or come in contact and say, well, no, this is 3 or 4 years out of date or whatever. So then that's another barrier. So it's just keeping that, you know, making sure who they need to go to, everything's in place, it's regularly refreshed. But I think more importantly as well, this is something that we're really pushing for, is making sure that housing contribute to these at a community safety partnership level. There is input from housing rather than just, you know, can we have this information sharing agreement? And sometimes, you know, if we're looking at it from a housing perspective, you might think, well, you know, the terms that don't necessarily sit right with us. So it's having the confidence to be part of that discussion, and to push to be part, to have that right to be part of that discussion, again, as not as a strategic authority, but we basically are, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you raise a really good point there, just which I just wanted to reflect back on, which is, I think sometimes housing providers need to be aware of the role that they play in information sharing, in terms of making sure that they're being specific with what they ask for, and not just specific with what they ask for, but also specific about the reason why they're asking for it. I think I've sometimes worked with clients who will say to me, oh, you know, the police won't share any information. And when you kind of look at examples of information sharing forms that they've completed, it's been really unclear exactly what they want or the reason why they want it, what they intend to do with it, you know, how they intend to use it. And I kind of look at it, and you can understand why perhaps the response that they've had back hasn't been particularly favourable. So I guess I always think it's important that we remember that we've all got responsibilities in this, and that part of the problem perhaps might be the way the information is being requested and what's being asked for.
And that's why we're looking at, where possible, joint training opportunities as well, just to have some brief sessions so we're clear on, you know, what to ask for and when, as you said, because ultimately if someone shares information inappropriately, they lose a job for it. Yeah. And again, there's all that whole thing about information going into the wrong hands, and you know, and you've got to, you know, a mountain of issues there. So it's just making sure that we are clear on that, and it is very case specific. And then hopefully people will be more comfortable about that.
Yeah, and I think it's also about being fair and reasonable as well, isn't it? I mean, I know for a fact that if I was a police officer who already had a lot of kind of pressures on my time and my capacity, if I was asked for a load of information and then didn't see that there was a response or a result from that information, then perhaps the next time that I'm asked, I'm going to be a little bit more reluctant to provide the information that's being asked for. So I think there's also something about being appreciative of other people's times and making sure that what we're asking for, there is a benefit from it.
And I think going back to that consistency as well, a lot of information sharing is so restricted to those personal relationships that people have developed, you know, links between I was an officer and a frontline police officer, or, you know, community safety officer in the council. And once that person's gone or left or been promoted, it's sometimes back to square one, and the new incumbent might have a different vision on that. So what we're trying to promote, and again, there's a long way to go, but we are seeing some green shoots, is, you know, if you ring in a local office or a local authority, or you know, you're asking for that information, they know why you're asking for it, and you're getting that joint response, because you could ring someone and they'd share information with you, and someone sat on a desk elsewhere in the office might say, no, I'm not giving you that. So again, it's making sure that everything's right and appropriate, but you're having that joint response. And again, you know, someone in one area might share information, then you go, say you go to the next local authority area, the next region, they might not at all, and you think, well, and it kind of puzzles you sometimes to think, and frustrates, you know, they've shared it, it's almost like a mirror image of the case, but the people in the other area haven't, and why? And it's getting that understanding and being clear on what it is they're worried about or concerned about or disapprove of.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I've done it myself, moved from working from one local authority area to another, and the differences, different police forces, and the differences between the information sharing approach, the partnership working, what they're willing to disclose, has just been light years apart. And I think, I'm sure you'd probably agree, I think the best and most effective ASB teams are those that have their partnership working and information sharing down. And they're the ones that are sharing more information and not less information. It's the right information and it's being done correctly. But the teams that are struggling are the ones that just can't get the information sharing right.
Absolutely. And again, it's looking at how we can overcome that and sharing the experiences in a certain area or a certain part of the country that have worked in others. And that is something that we're looking at doing on the back of some of the work we've done in West Yorkshire. We're able to go to other areas and kind of have those conversations, because the housing providers we're working with are national. So if something's working in one area, then say we've got another part of the country, you know, with similar situations, but, you know, we're having the door closed on us. So we're going to visit those contacts in that area with representatives often from the police into West Yorkshire will come down with us, and we'll have those conversations. They'll have the discussions with their counterparts, and we'll kind of say, right, well, let's put something in place and keep it simple, but have that clarity.
Absolutely. And so since you've been doing the work, what would you say has been kind of the biggest successes and conversely the biggest challenges that you've come across so far?
I mean, the challenges are still the mental health element as well. I think whoever nails that down in the housing world will be will probably get a knighthood, won't they? But that's a massive challenge. And again, there's so many complexities to that, and I think we just need to keep hammering away at it to make sure to get mental health teams around the table and have that dialogue and see those results. I think one of the successes has just been uncomplicating things, and also the work we've done around county lines has been really interesting. Again, I think that almost been a good example of, say, of a little bit of a quick fix to a long-term problem, if you can say that. Just, you know, the benefit of having all that knowledge of a housing provider in the community, people who get into people's homes more and more, probably more than any other agency. And to see that link up between frontline policing and serious regional organised crime groups, and having the bigger picture there. So something that might seem really trivial in a housing estate can lead to possibly case building for a conviction against, you know, a national or even international drug dealer in the most extreme situations. So it's having that value. And I think that we've really connected with that, and we've worked in a number of different regions. We've had a lot of buy-in and a great deal of support from police colleagues with that, which has been fantastic. So if we were looking at moving towards premises closure orders, looking at those applications, although we can't do them ourselves and there's been barriers, then through working with the regional organised crime units, we've been able to quicken things up because it's in their interest as well, and they recognise the work that we're doing. So if something was anticipated to take a couple of months, then ideally there's no reason why we can't turn something around in a couple of weeks or less. And again, it's that whole impact in the community, what people are seeing. You know, they've known that that particular property on the estate has blighted the community. They know there's ASB, there's criminality, there's everything that goes on there. And to send that message out, to get that closed down and to get those arrests, but also working with the third sector and charities and schools as well to work with young people and to help them move forward with their lives and before they haven't gone too deep into it. So you've got those two approaches. You're sort of hitting the criminality as hard as possible with the resources and the evidence and everything that goes with it, but also making sure that there's opportunities and, you know, meaningful opportunities for young people, not kind of gimmicky tick boxing type projects, I guess, really, you know, because young people in those areas who've had a difficult life are, for want of a better term, streetwise. So they need to know that, you know, what you're doing to help and support them is going to have an outcome, is going to interest them, is going to help them move away from this particular path they've gone down for whatever reason and help them come out the other side. So again, it's about getting their buy-in. And again, as I mentioned, you know, numerous times during our conversation, this whole thing about trust and what you can contribute to helping that person or that community as well. So that's worked really good. And we've almost started a bit of a model in the area that we're looking at trying to replicate and share with colleagues in other areas, particularly the work with the regional organised crime units. So that's been a real positive. It's looking really at the moment, we're looking at kind of, you know, firming up the membership of the Best Practice Partnership Network. Again, it is really flexible. And we're looking at, we've had some conversations with Daha as well to look at kind of replicating almost the pledge approach there. So housing providers would basically sign up to the Best Practice Partnership Network and agree to share information, to work in partnership and to keep vulnerable people safe. Really sort of, you know, three strands to that. And, you know, and getting people signed up that way. So again, that's the gateway into the information sharing. Everyone will have their own information sharing agreements internally. They'll also be signed up to the relevant protocols with the CSPs and other organisations. So everything's all backed up. And I think also, which in my experience hasn't happened much at all, is getting that dialogue between the solicitors who work on behalf of housing providers, local authority solicitors and force solicitors, because, you know, in a lot of situations, they're completely separate. I don't know how you feel about that. And, you know, so wherever we can build those relationships there to share ideas and to work collaboratively, save money as well and time and in the best interest of all concerned, rather than, you know, having that almost disjointed approach between those three legal elements, I guess.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting what you were saying there about the serious organised crime units within the police. I think that's probably another example of where, you know, the need to raise the profile of housing, because I think very unlikely that anyone working in that unit would even have any idea of the value that housing might be able to bring to the work they're doing. I suppose there's that kind of, there's no point waiting for them to come to housing's door. It really is about housing kind of going to them and outlining what's possible. If there is a kind of listener kind of thinking that, you know, they want to get more involved with those kind of teams within the police, I mean, how did you go about that? What kind of advice would you give?
I think really, speaking to colleagues from the regional organised crime units, they've been quite surprised themselves, and they've almost been converted as to what housing can bring to the table. So again, finding out who they are, and again, it's contacts through contacts, I guess, really. And some of the meetings that we've had with developing those links have been kind of chance meetings at conferences and things like that, to be honest with you. But once we've had that dialogue, it's kind of developed from there. And we've been able to, you know, speak to our colleagues in West Yorkshire, and if there's been an issue in another area, they've put us in touch with their counterparts, which has been really helpful. So if you're working on behalf of that housing association who needs to get into that other area, then that gives us that link, and it's beneficial to everyone concerned. And I think it does often take some of the strain off neighbourhood policing as well, who may be, you know, possibly uncomfortable about dealing with premises closures in some areas. Again, don't get me wrong, there's some fantastic work happening all over the country and, you know, really dedicated, experienced people. But there is still that nervousness sometimes about, you know, going down that route of premises closure. And I think the frustrations for us as well is that we don't have the powers at the moment. And again, that's something that via the network and links with the PCC, we're kind of looking to explore, you know, is there any scope for lobbying there to, you know, to get housing providers the powers? So yeah, you know, that's possibly something to think about. And the conversations you do have with police colleagues is, in the main, certainly over the last few months in particular, they're very much in favour of it. But again, it's not necessarily a straightforward matter when, you know, legislation has to be changed.
No, and I think, but saying that, I know that there are lots of, you know, a trustee for ASB Help, the charity, and I know that there's sort of started to be created a bit of a wish list of a number of things that might need changing. So, you know, perhaps if that wish list gets long enough, then we might have a chance of making some difference. Because I've always thought it's incredibly perverse that the organisation that owns the property can't be the ones that actually get the closure order. And I think it's a bit of a gap in the legislation. So, yeah, I would totally agree and support that housing providers should be able to use the closure order as a important tool in tackling some of the ASB that they'll have within their stock. I think the pledge also sounds like an incredibly exciting opportunity. And I wondered whether you were able to tell me a little bit more about, you know, that kind of county lines model that you've kind of evolving.
Again, really simple. Anything that's a whiff of county lines or cuckooing from housing officers, from ASB officers, that comes to us, we just feed it into the regional organised crime unit. And if it's linked to something big, it's on their intelligence system. We get the support from frontline staff as well to look at that, to make sure that there's the dialogue there with the housing teams to put plans in place in terms of support, or if there's any operations to be built, then looking at it that way. So it really is as wide and open as that, if there's a county lines issue or a suspected one. And I think the regional organised crime units are seeing more and more of that because of the work we've been doing with housing, the various seminars and conferences we've had over the last 12 months in different parts of the country. It's on everyone's radar. So they're going out into the community and they're picking up on those signals, those hunches, and then they're either feeding it in direct or we're feeding it in for them. And that's on the intelligence base there. You know, and sometimes the feedback we get that they perhaps wouldn't have thought it as county lines before. Think, hang about, this is, you know, even something as, you know, people finding, you know, a grandparent has found knives under someone's bed. They've turned up with, you know, £400 pair of trainers on, the school, you know, they've maybe been suspended from school, or there's issues that aren't right and things like that. All those small things are leading to a bigger picture. And I think it's subtly investigating with that. And again, the support that we can offer to parents, grandparents, guardians, who perhaps will be reluctant to come to housing with an issue like that because they would have thought that the response was, right, I could lose my home because of some criminality going on in there. And again, it's looking at that bigger picture and separating the issues within that, so that young person and the family can get the support. And again, it'll take a lot of guts for them to come to us to say, you know, these are the issues I want, you know. And often, you know, they're unable to give that control to a young person who is very strong-minded, or, you know, and it's difficult for them. So if they're reaching out to help, then how can we help them? And what resources can we put in place? And I think working with the Children's Society, Railway Children, other support agencies as well, has been really useful as well. So you've got all the different strands of the process, and they've got the expertise to work with young people, to support them, to give that advice, to look at sort of the preventative approach. You've got housing dealing with sort of the tenancies and the estate management and the community safety element there, and then you've got the criminal element as well. So everything's all working together.
And I think that's a really important point, isn't it? Because, you know, we've talked for years about the fact that housing providers are expected to be an awful lot of things, but actually we can't be expected to be everything. And there are going to be things that are just beyond our specialism. And, you know, you talked about support, working with young people. You know, they very often are going to need people that have expertise and specialisms that housing officers don't have. So it just kind of picks up again that importance of that multi-agency working and that problem-solving approach that you're clearly seeking to put in place. Before we wrap up, I guess one of the things that's in my mind is you've talked about a number of things that I imagine has been of a great deal of interest to listeners. I mean, certainly I really like, you know, when I asked you the question between what's the difference between this problem solving model and others, I liked the kind of just trying to take out the complexity, you know, making things simple. And I think we are guilty sometimes of making things overly challenging and not overly complex. So if people are listening and thinking, I really like the sound of this, sounds exactly the way we want to go forward, how do people get in touch with you to find out more about what you've done, or perhaps to find out more about this pledge as it evolves? How can people reach out?
Just contact me direct via email, and I can have a discussion with them and kind of take it from there. I think what's been useful as well is we're working with different organisations throughout the country as well. There's often very similar themes, so we can hopefully put them in touch with counterparts in other areas and get things moving. That's certainly the plan.
And I'm going to ask the question, if you don't mind, because I feel a bit awkward asking, but I imagine it is going on in most people's heads. You obviously do work for Forbes. Is the any cost attached to people getting in contact with you and asking for more information?
Not at all. No, that's the beauty of it. Again, it's almost like, well, for me, it's a commitment to working with the housing sector, as I've done for many years. Obviously, if a case does come out of that, then that's a separate discussion to be had with that housing provider regarding sort of, you know, any casework or legal work beyond that. But in terms of getting the resources, the information in place within this network, it's in everyone's interest. It's beneficial to Forbes. It's beneficial to all the organisations, our clients and others. So again, it's kind of something that sits central to everything. And then any sort of casework decisions, any enforcement beyond that is a separate conversation for them to be had or to take back to their own organisations. So yeah, it's just something that hopefully is simple and gets answers for people. And I think what's been really good is people can contact us, and we're looking at getting an app in place as well, which should be kind of monitored through Forbes and the Office of the Police and Crime Commissioner, obviously with, you know, all the relevant permissions and everything in the background there, looking at what the issues are and also some good practice examples as well. So ideally, if someone has an issue in a particular town, then we can say, right, we know someone in there who's having the same problems, or someone who's overcome that elsewhere. And again, getting those results. And I think before, well, even in the last, I'm just thinking off the top of my head now, in the last, 6 months or so, since it was officially launched, I forgot to say that before, in September of last year, when the network was officially launched, and we were looking at having another session in May with the Police and Crime Commissioner, but obviously with COVID-19 and everything, that's been put on hold, but we're still following up with that. But if someone can contact us and say, you know, we need to contact someone in this particular, we've got this issue, we don't know who to contact, we've been able to, as a quick fix, and again, it's not time intensive on us as well, go to that person, that organisation, and say, X housing association is having this problem. Can you get someone who can give them the answers and contact them and can make a decision? And they're like, yeah, sure, thankfully. So that's been really good. So I haven't, and because they know it's supported by that many agencies at a larger strategic level, then, you know, we've been around, we've had conversations with directors of community safety, local authorities, for example, and having their buy-in as well. So I think when you've got the buy-in strategically and operationally, then it avoids housing providers getting stuck in the middle when they're looking at progressing cases. So there's no cost at all, no.
Thank you. I'm glad you don't mind me asking that question. But I
No, of course. No, I bet people would be wondering. People often think, you know, what's,
I didn't want
sometimes
people kind of being put off contacting you, thinking that they were going to end up with a bill in the post.
What's so it going to do with solicitors and sales pitch?
I knew what the
pitch
answer was going to be. I was confident I knew the answer before I asked the question, but I thought it was
No, that's okay. I think there's been a bit, when we first did the fact finding and looking at setting up the partnership, people were thinking, well, you know what, what solicitors do in leading on this, and when they understand and they get the fact that it's basically an extension of those housing providers to provide that support. That's a really nice again,
fantastic. So are you okay with me? If I can share your email address when this podcast goes out via my mailing list and on my website, are you happy for that to be included?
Yes, of course, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Darren, I think that just leaves me to say a huge thank you. As I said, I'm really, really grateful for you giving up your time. Really grateful for you sharing some of your expertise and some of your experiences. And I think the problem-solving model sounds really exciting. And hopefully we'll see it being rolled out further. So thank you very much, Darren.
Thank you.
And thank you to everybody who's taken the time out to listen to this episode. Standard rules apply. So if you've got any suggestions for topics that you would like me to be discussing on future episodes, then please do let me know. You can find me on social media and obviously through my email address. Alternatively, if you are feeling particularly brave and would like to come on and be a guest, I promise to make it as painless as possible. Other than that, thank you for joining me and see you next time. Goodbye.